Welcome to Regenerative Mindset. In this podcast, we'll explore fresh ideas and inspiring stories from trusted voices who share practical wisdom on bringing positive change to our lives, our society, and our world. I'm your host, Stacey Pollice. As a psychologist, regenerative farmer, and climate activist, I've developed a deep curiosity for thriving ecosystems. Whether it's on my avocado ranch in Southern California or in the ways we engage with each other. Join me as I chat with brilliant guests who challenge our thinking and expand our understanding of how we can live more sustainably, healthfully, and regeneratively, to give back more than we take. Together, we'll see how personal healing can create a ripple effect that reaches our communities and even the earth beneath our feet. So let's get curious together. In this episode of Regenerative Mindset, I am joined by my friend Catherine Whitecloud, a revered community leader, knowledge keeper, and advocate from Weipazoka Wakpa Dakota Nation. She was chosen when she was just 16 years old to represent her community and has spent over three decades serving as a spokesperson and leader in various roles, including Chief, Director of Education, CEO for the Assembly of First Nations, and regional chief of the Assembly of Manitoba Chiefs. There's so much to say about her life experience and wisdom, but essentially her life's work is dedicated to ensuring that the teachings and vision of her ancestors continue to guide and shape future generations. In our conversation, Catherine shares powerful insights on the deep connection between Indigenous knowledge, land stewardship, and community well-being. She speaks to the importance of language and how it shapes our thinking and understanding of the world, as meanings of words and storytelling in her native tongue could be considered the exact opposite of English. In the true sense of education, honoring traditional ways of speaking and learning wisdom passed down through generations holds the key to sustainability, resilience, and harmony with the earth. We discuss the vital role of youth in carrying forward these teachings and the responsibility we all share in protecting our natural world for seven generations forward. Join me for this inspiring discussion with Catherine Whitecloud as we explore the power of Indigenous knowledge, the strength found in community, and the urgent need to honor and protect the wisdom of those who came before us. Hello, Catherine. Thank you so much for being here. I've been looking forward to this for a long time.
Hi, Stacey. It's wonderful to see you.
You and I met in 2014. You were in Santa Barbara for the film festival for a film you participated in, Bridgewalkers. And I got lucky, and your husband, Bruce, got to stay with me. And besides having a magnificent film that you can tell us a little tiny bit about, which is so relevant, of course, still, but you and I really bonded, the three of us bonded around education and children and values. Also, what was key for me was well-being and all these principles that are really prominent in your culture that you come from. So I just kind of wanted to name how you and I met.
Bridgewalkers happened over, I think, a couple of years after we met your colleagues that came up and became interested in what we were doing as a council of elders. And it was about bridging our knowledge and our history and the history of our knowledge with what's happening right now around the world to our earth, the trauma that she's in right now, the challenges that we're all facing as humanity because of our own actions and what we've done to harm our mother, the earth. And that's how Bridgewalkers evolved, based on knowledge of ancestors, knowledge of our current Indigenous relatives from South America, from Greenland, from North America, And I believe those were the participants in that particular film. And it was a coming together of knowledge, which we all share. It's very much like-minded. How we process the knowledge may be a little bit different, but the understandings are all the same about our responsibilities, our role, and what our purpose here is on Earth, what it is that we're supposed to be doing. So that's what Bridgewalkers was about.
So Kara Rhodes was one of the producers, or the producer, right? And she lives here in Santa Barbara. It was a really good film. I think it's still worth watching. But yes, so how do you tie together the cultures that share values? I mean, I like the word indigenous, and I wonder if that resonates, if you wanted to talk generally.
Yes, indigenous, although it tends to be used quite loosely these days, indigenous for us is those people who are original to the land. Like, we have no place else but here. This is where we came from, and this is where we were born on the land, like I was. And this is home for us. We may move, we may transplant ourselves, but it's still home. This is where we come from. So that's how we understand indigenous. And in my travels around the world, I've been blessed with the opportunity to meet many indigenous groups. And I have learned through our gatherings that we all carry the same understandings and the same beliefs. Again, how we give voice to it may be a little bit different, but the foundation is the same. And the outcomes are usually the same. And so we are truly connected in our responsibilities, our roles, and what we're here for, as well as the responsibility that was given to us through creation and why we are where we are. We all have different areas of this earth that we're responsible for caring for, and we're very cognizant of that.
So just to be clear, you are in Canada right now, and that's where you call home. And the name of your tribe, community, again, I want to get the language right. What's the name of your community or tribe? And is it a community or a tribe, or are they interchangeable?
This is where it becomes difficult, because our language is so very unique. It's difficult to translate into English. So what we end up doing is it's more descriptive than anything else, but commonly referred to by, say, modern literature and how we were identified by government sources, is our band is the outcropping of a much larger group, which is We Are Dakota. My community, the traditional name that it was known by, or my band, our band, was called Weepazoka Wakba. And Weepazoka is Saskatoon, and Wakba is creek or river. And it was our traditional berry picking area. And that's where we live now, along a creek that goes into a major river. So it's in a valley. And if we were to visit old people or elderly people from others of our Dakota relatives, because we're all over North America, we are in Minnesota, South Dakota, Nebraska, Colorado, Montana, Manitoba, Saskatchewan, and the foothills of the Rockies in Alberta. And the history shows that we used to be in North Central Ontario in Canada, as well as Northern Quebec, and as well as far south as South and North Carolina. So our territory was vast at one time, a shared territory. And to claim anything as territory is really putting ourselves in a situation where we are accountable and responsible for the caretaking of the territory also. And so being respectful of how we shared it in our culture and in other Indigenous cultures, no one owns land. It's shared and it's held for all of us to thrive on, to be able to live a good, healthy life, and to support and help each other. Yes, there were animosities, but it was more about if we encroached on each other's territory, or if our men were stealing wives during battles, or horses. Horses was a big deal too. So we are Indigenous to North America, and our Indigenous relatives in South America, whom we've met through Bridgewalkers also, have the same foundation. And in fact, we have the same, what we were taught as children about the future, the same, I don't want to say visions, but...
like prophecy?
Prophecies, yes. The same prophecies. And that we would come together And we are in that era now where we were going to come together. It's like the eagle and the condor concept, that we were going to come together out of necessity and out of, it's just going to naturally happen because of the state of the earth and our responsibility to do what we're supposed to do to protect her.
So this gets into, let's say, the beliefs. And so you're saying the prophecies and then outcomes of the multitude of what I might refer to as indigenous peoples. Let's talk about that a little bit, because my understanding is there's just a tremendous nature orientation, because there's a belief and an understanding that we are all of this earth and of the same creator. So we're all related. It is non-hierarchical in terms of species. Could you help us understand what the core beliefs, I mean, obviously this could be a much longer conversation, but just to give us a sense of what that looks like.
I was raised, and as we all are as Indigenous people, that we are placed here, or we come to Earth for a very specific purpose. Generally, our purpose is to care for the land, because we would be nothing. There would be no life if we didn't have land, if we didn't have water, if we didn't have air. And the land provides everything for humanity to have a good, healthy life. If it was left in its purity as it was originally provided to us, we could survive forever with what the land provides for us. The water would always be there. The fruit would always be there. The wild vegetables would always be there. The animals would always be there to provide us with protein if we needed it. It was a beautiful balance to be able to live on the land and off the land. And all of us as Indigenous peoples believe in that. And so we are very cognizant and very much carry the weight of the responsibility of caring for her to ensure that 7 generations from now, our children and our grandchildren will have an earth that will provide them the sustenance they require to live a good life. That's our only purpose, is to care for her so we can live a good life, nurturing our children and our grandchildren to fulfill their responsibilities and their purpose for coming into this world. And so as I come into this stage of wearing a white crown now, I'm really, really cognizant of that. And so that is what my focus is now, very much so. My children are grown up. I have grandchildren. So I'm not so much focused on work like I used to be, but rather on my role and my purpose and what it was I was placed here to do and what that means for me and how do I fulfill it. Pretty much everybody else would have that same. You would too, because we are all equal. We're not different. We were given responsibilities for why we're here. Our purposes may be a little bit different, but in the end, it coalesces into one, because if we don't have land and we don't have water, we don't have air, how do we survive? The earth will always survive. We won't, as human beings, because we're the last on the rung of the ladder of creation. Everything else can survive without us. We can't survive without the land and without the water and the air.
That's an interesting thing to say. I have not heard that said. We are the last rung on the ladder of life.
We are the weakest rung on the ladder.
Ooh. Something interesting I wanted to comment on. As we're recording this, there are fires blazing in Los Angeles. And I just watched a YouTube or something of a woman that lives locally who was talking about the native practice of burning, controlled burning. And so there was even a role for humans with nature to keep it in balance. We had a role. If we know what that is and we keep to our place, there is a role. Humans had a role to keep fires from running wild.
Yeah. And I read that also, or I heard it as I was watching clips of what was happening in LA. There was something called back then was control burn. And really it was for fire guarding, but it also was to, so that certain of I want to say weeds, because we introduce things to different parts of land that aren't native to the land. And it was to control that and to keep it in its natural state. We also do control burns, or my father and my brother used to. And it was a means of protecting, as well as having what was burnt to go back into the land as nourishment. And that was practiced forever to protect that. So what is happening right now? You know, a lot of people, and I've heard it also, and there's various different approaches or understandings of it, is, oh, well, Earth is showing that she's stronger than man. Fires weren't created by nature. Those fires are created by whatever we've done to the land, whatever created that situation. I don't know how the fire started. I haven't heard about how it started. Have you? No?
No. I heard mention of arson, but I don't know if all of them were arson. And I don't know if it's confirmed at this point.
Okay.
But lightning has existed for a very long time.
Yes, lightning will. Lightning can. And usually when lightning does it, you'll see that everything come back so full and so green. Yes, it may take away, but it brings everything back to its most healthy state. Much like when we had COVID and everybody had to bunker down. I mean, I saw all the pictures from around the world, how animals were coming back into the towns and the streets. The water became blue. Everything was clean after a very short period of time. So the land was rejuvenating itself with us off of it. And that's natural. That's a natural process. Our arrogance to think that we rule the land and that we control it, it's getting us into trouble is what it's doing. And our role is to get the message out there. And there are scientists around the world that acknowledge that how to address climate change and the damage we've done to Earth, that knowledge lies within our people. And we've said that for centuries. So that's one of our roles, our primary responsibilities, to care for what we've been given, to have what we call a good life, a healthy one.
And share with those of us who may have forgotten what those values are. So when you and I met, I was deeply involved in education, and my dissertation was called The Colonized Child. And it was about the well-being of children in schools. And it really resonates a lot of the care, connection, community, and choice the children said were central to their ability to learn made sense to you, and the values of a Native American. No, well, it's First Nations education. Is that how we call it?
It's just a word, because those are the descriptors that are attached to us by government and other entities. We just call ourselves individually, as tribal people, like we're Dakota, our neighbors are Anishinaabe, our northern relatives are Cree, our eastern relatives are Mohawk and Iroquois and so on. And so the terminology is what's been used to describe us, and it's not something that we use. But people say Indigenous, people say First Nation. At one time it was Aboriginal. It's kind of all over the place.
Or Indian is the old-fashioned word.
The Indian, yeah.
Yeah, that's old-fashioned. But what's interesting is that what I was looking at is a version, a much lighter version of the Indian schools that were imposed on 150,000 children in Canada, I believe, that were only closed in 1996, I believe. But the goals were the same. They were to indoctrinate and control and subdue, essentially, you might say, a renegade way of being, thinking, and, you know, somebody that would fall in line with a dominant culture. Same goal. And that's what I was seeing and really reading Indigenous literature and literature on different types of thinking that is more close to nature and land. Having been robbed of that has the same effect that we're doing in our schools, our public schools. It's just a lighter version, and it's been normalized. But that degree of alienation from self, alienation from nature, alienation from the land has allowed for a real runaway culture that seems destructive.
The education system, and there's plenty of information out there about it now. There's films and movies about it. I just watched another one again 2 weeks ago, a new one that's come out. They're not even ancestors. My cousins, my oldest brother, my parents, were forced into what was called residential schools under threat of incarceration of parents if the children weren't in school. Parents were punished if they didn't listen to, at the time, the Indian agent who was a federal employee. If they, say, went hunting and did something that the Indian agent didn't agree with, well, then his children would be used against him and say, okay, you're not going to see your children until next summer because you didn't listen to me. So there were many, many incidents that, well, I would probably say 90% of children who were taken and placed in these residential schools, which were like institutions meant to harm our children. They were established to take the Indian out of the child. That's what it was called. Punished if they spoke their language. Punished if they interacted with their siblings in the schools. They weren't allowed to even interact with their siblings. And this is horrible to say, but it's a truth. Most of them were run by Catholic churches, raped by priests. Young girls were having babies in these residential schools. The infants were thrown into furnaces or buried, all of that. And that history now, what we have is a backlash to the truth of that history, which has been shared, at least in Canada, it's been documented extensively. Now what we have is called denialism. People that are not of our nations who are saying, well, that never happened. Even government people, even people who were elected and voted into government saying, well, those schools were intended for the best thing for these people or those people. And only good things came out of that. And those that ran them should be praised, etc., you know, rewarded. When the intent was to harm our people through our children. And it was done until 1996, like you said. And it wasn't just girls who were being raped. Our brothers, our little brothers were also being raped. Tremendous amount of damage and trauma inflicted. The beatings, you know, the starvation, just things that you would never expect to happen here in Canada or the United States. You would never think it would happen. I know our American relatives are still repatriating their children that were buried out east in different residential school areas, that are, they are now repatriating them home to their homelands. It's the same thing here. It's pain and it's trauma that is multi-generational and intergenerational. It continues in the sense that people haven't had the opportunity to recover from that trauma because that trauma continued on even today. And we talked about this briefly or an hour last time, that we still are on reservations and we still have boundaries around our people. We still have that ostracization from society because we are seen as being less than. We were not considered human. According to law, we were not human. So even though the intent was of the education systems that were brought down on us was to take the Indian out of us and to force us into living into the mainstream society as it's seen now, they don't want us there. So what was the purpose of doing all of this if we weren't going to be accepted in society? So there's that huge difference in understanding and so on, but the whole purpose of attempting to take our languages away from us to place us on these small tracts of land, basically it was we were subservient to the Indian agent.
And disconnected from your roots and your history and your identity. And the idea is assimilate with the white European, you might call it European, but it's now the Americas, culture, which essentially has you disappear, but you can't. So then, okay, fine, if you take the goal of assimilating, you can't because you will always be other.
That's right. We're always other. And we have a responsibility to ensure that as those other, which is, I'm part of that, that we survive because we have a specific purpose here. We were given a beautiful gift of language and a way of life and a responsibility that we have to fulfill. And so to try to take that away from us, it didn't work. We're still here. And that's the role I'm in right now in ensuring that our language survives and thrives, in ensuring that knowledge that was passed on to me and to others of my generation from our great-grandparents and our grandparents, that it thrives through our children and our grandchildren. And the challenge is that those who went to residential schools, and those are people of my generation and older, my parents' generation, my grandparents never went to residential school. My parents did, and my cousins, the older siblings. The damage that was done and the trauma that was inflicted is to recover from that and to become whole again as Dakota people, to become whole so that we can pass that knowledge on to our grandchildren. Our children are now adults. So our responsibility as grandparents, which has always been the responsibility of grandparents, is to ensure that the knowledge is carried forward. We all have specific roles. As a grandmother, my primary responsibility towards my grandchildren is to ensure that they learn those stories and teachings that my grandmother passed on to me at night. Storytelling is in wintertime. How we learned by listening, the lessons in those stories, because they're real. They're real about how we treat each other, about how we hunt, about how we gather, about how we perform a lot of functions that sustained us in the past and still sustain us today. Our education system has the mandate to go full immersion in our language in Dakota. In our language are the unwritten rules of how we are to conduct ourselves, our lives as individuals and as a people, and our responsibilities, what that is, what that means, how we fulfill them. And if we don't have the language, if the language is being lost, then that knowledge is also lost. And that's why it's so critical that we put all our efforts into ensuring that our language survives. It would be like if your English language was taken away from you, how would you survive?
I speak Spanish, and there's ways of expressing myself in Spanish. There are certain words and expressions that I want to use, even though I'm speaking English. I want to borrow something from Spanish because it just says it better. And so the way that the translation of the native language comes through, it seems like it's embedded in nature reference. Even people's proper names often bring animals or weather events or natural phenomenon into their name. So I can only imagine, that's all I can do, is imagine that the way the language is spoken is completely woven into a different understanding than English, put it that way.
Yes, definitely. English is a complete reverse of our language. And you're aware of ESL, English is a second language, that when a child is learning English and it's not their natural language, you have to take the time to take that English language, translate it into your own language and your own thought process, and then translate back again or attempt to into English. So what it does is it forces us to think backwards from our natural way of viewing and seeing things and from our natural spoken language. And that's what's been done, especially if you start having it imposed on you or you don't hear your own language from childhood. Now, I didn't speak English until I was 7 years old when I started school because my grandmother didn't speak any English, my father's mother. We grew up with my father's family. So we only spoke Dakota at home until she completed her walk in life in 1973, I believe, January of 1973. And so we always spoke Dakota at home. It was natural. It came naturally. And when you hear it around you, it just flows naturally. And the challenge we have is that our young ones, our children, are not hearing it every day because their parents don't speak it all the time at home. And so we're reintroducing it into our schools as the official language of our people. And so we have fluent speakers in our school to help our children, for them to hear it every day. They're not necessarily there to teach. It's to speak the language so the children will learn by hearing it, which is how I learned. It was never taught to me. I was immersed in it. I heard it all the time.
It's a natural capacity of children to absorb language and identify meaning. And the earlier you expose, the better. I have a question because locally we have a school, Adelante, that teaches Spanish and English, but it really greater and greater percentage of the children's learning is in Spanish as they progress through the grades. And I'm wondering, is this, which it's a special charter school, is this a special charter school? Is it just something you've been able to add to the Canadian public school system? Is it a private school in your area? How is that being enacted?
Because our schools are located what we call on reservations, and our relationship is directly with the federal government. So the state government, or in Canada, it's called the provincial government, is not necessarily involved. They do, in a sense of imposed assessment processes for grading, like for grade levels. So you have to pass certain curriculum testing in order to pass on to the next level. Our approach to this is that we will have our own school because there's been so much research done that it's understood by government officials that English has actually damaged our education systems. According to our ways, we never sat in classrooms. We never sat in square rooms to learn. Our learning happened at home and on the land. So we're taking it back out there. We're still in the schools right now as we transition into this process. But I always use the example of my grandson, my youngest grandson. When my brother started teaching him to hunt when he was 4 years old, and he had his first moose kill when he was 10. And I asked assessment specialists, people who, that's all they do, is devise assessment tools for education systems. And I posed the question to them. I said, how do you assess a 10-year-old going out hunting in the middle of winter in minus 30 degree weather and it's windy, and he goes out with his grandpa and he knows where to walk? First, he puts out the tobacco to offer and ask for the blessing of having a moose cross his path. And he's asking for a moose to present itself as nourishment, food for the family. Walk so that the moose doesn't know he's there by walking not upwind, but downwind, so the moose can't smell him, finding a place to be able to understand that a moose is going to cross that way, and also to set himself up so that he knows the direction of the wind, how strong the wind is, and what direction it's going to come from, and then seeing it and being able to pull a trigger to fell a moose without damaging it. And I asked this assessment, how do you assess that? Because there's science involved, there's math involved, there's weather, climate, all of that is involved. So how do you assess that? I said, because you don't know how to hunt a moose. Have you ever hunted a moose? Have you ever gone on the land? And none of them could answer. And so I talked about it some more. And at the end, the eldest assessment specialist said, well, the outcome, he felled the moose. That's the assessment. So we are changing and developing that as the assessment tools for our children in their own natural environment. How do they live and how are they able to maintain a healthy life with their language and with those teachings of the land so that they can not only live but thrive?
So it's given the relevant context, assess them based on their context. I just read an article this morning that was talking about how, newsflash, they're considering ADHD. It's so prominent, so more and more prevalent, and maybe it's not detectable in the brain. There's no chemistry or any other kind of dysfunction they can find. Maybe it's a normal reaction to children being presented with information in a way they can't process it. There's people that process differently, but they're still normal because there are so many people. And take it out of dis-ease, disordered, you're a problem category. And to me, this speaks to that. You know, that child that can do that high level problem solving and skill and precision may not do well on a timed multiple choice test of some kind. You know, that's possible.
It's the same as putting a child in a cage. To put them in a square box classroom and say, this is what you're going to do, and not learning naturally. Our way is to learn naturally. It's we're going to teach our 12 to 14, 15 year olds how to build their own home, their own log cabins, how to be able to sustain that naturally without electricity, internet, etc. And how do you do that? Because that's what I grew up in. And it was the happiest time of my life. We want them to know that. We want them to learn that you can build your own home. You don't need to wait for someone to give you permission. Just go and do it. You can have a safe place. Just go and do it. So the answers are so simple. What we do is we confuse it and we make it complicated and convoluted, unless it's understood by the outside sources, who are the ones that control the process.
Well, it's funny. We have to hear about it from science. It's like, guess what? Scientists have discovered what we've known all along. Some people never let go of it. So there are a couple of programs that my kids participated in this town. One was Santa Barbara Middle School, which has a large outdoor component, which introduces a lot of ritual and self-reflection and learning about conducting oneself in nature. But also the Mad Academy my kids went to, there was always a week-long project where they went, for some of my kids, they went to an Apache reservation in Arizona and built homes. And literally the experience of doing that was so powerful. I mean, here are the regulations. All they could do would be sweep floors and like carry nails. But on the reservation, and then also sometimes in Mexico, they're allowed to actually build homes for people. And they did this for someone else. And the learning and the true self-esteem that comes of it is powerful.
It's like when little kids, especially little boys, build tree houses. It's the same process, but it's actually a real home. And how much kids love it, like how much they enjoy having a tree house and learning that. And back then, toys were natural, right? Swings, climbing trees, you know, swimming in the swimming hole, in the creek. We're of the last generation where we could say we actually got our drinking water from the creek. So, you know, to be able to carry that knowledge forward of how that used to all be maintained by the beavers upstream who built dams so we could have water, you know, and I'm assuming science learned from beavers that they can build dams to, you know, back up water. How else would they learn that? And we have, I say, absconded with the lessons from nature and claimed it as our own rather than giving credit to nature for teaching us. And we have to go back to that and learning and observing, because if we don't, we are harming our grandchildren.
I like that, learning and observing, because that is underrated. Listening and learning and observing. I want to back up a little bit and ask you a little bit more about your education and upbringing, because I know you have some initials after your name, which has allowed you to function at administrative higher levels. You're representing your country, not just your nation, but also Canada. And yet you learned from your grandmother until you were 7. I know your brother, who you lost this year, which is a big deal, that you grew up together. Could you back up and just tell us a little bit about how you came to be this person that maybe walks both worlds so well?
Firstly, I was born at home. My mother's mother and her two sisters delivered me at home. Our culture is pretty much matrilineal, but in our specific situation, in our case, we grew up with my father's family. It was a wonderful childhood. I and my brother, who was 1 year younger than me, we chose to live with our paternal grandmother, and we didn't call her grandmother. Her name was Kunshi, which means grandmother in our language. We lived with her to care for her because she lived in a one-room log house that was built by my father and his brother-in-laws. One room, dirt floor with linoleum on it, wood stove, a stand for 2 pails of water, a table and 2 chairs, my Kunshi's bed and another bed. That was it. That was all that was in that home. Fresh cardboard on the walls in wintertime for insulation. Fresh clay mud on the outside for wintertime. One door and one window. Wintertime, we melted snow for water. And we used to go in the mornings and set snare lines with our Kunshi before we went to school. And we walked to school. At the time, there was what was called a day school in the community, which came after residential schools. We walked to school and we would set our snare lines in the morning with her. And she was really good at it. And whatever was in the snare line at the end of the day was what we had for supper. And it was always healthy. Because whatever we ate off the land, their sustenance was also off the land. So it was all healthy. It was natural. He and I lived with her until I want to say about age 10, 11, 12, somewhere in there. Off and on, I lived with her on weekends when I was sent away to go to high school. So I went to school in the community. The teachers were from outside the community. We had to learn English. We had to follow the state curriculum guidelines. The principal lived right at the school, who was sent in by the government. The teachers were hired by the government. And we went to school in the community until the integration movements of the 60s. Our school was shut down in 1964. And then we were bused into the surrounding communities, the surrounding towns outside of the reservation to go to school. We were to be immersed and we were to be integrated into society. So we rode the bus to those schools every day. I did that until eighth grade. And then I was placed in what's called private home placement. So I was placed with a family in the city to go to high school. Because there was no high school in the town that we were being bused to. We didn't have an education system in our community. So I was placed with a family that I'd never met before. A week before school was going to start, and I was 13 at the time, to start ninth grade. The father was a professor in the university. The mother was a stay-at-home mother. I went to school in what was called a rich kid's school in the west end of town where the doctor's kids, professor's kids, etc. went to school. Very large school, 1,000 students. My first year was the only Indian kid. It was really difficult in the sense of they had no clue about my background. They assumed that everyone of my color of skin spoke the same language. The assumption was that I was dumb, that I couldn't speak English, all of that. I had completed high school, though, with the support of my house parent, the father, but also with the support of a particular teacher in the school who saw that I had some athletic ability. And as long as you're a jock in the high schools, you are somebody. And so he involved me in 4 sports in school. And that's what got me through high school, because I had to maintain a certain grade point average to be involved in sports. But not only that, because I was involved in sports, I was a jock. And so then I became not necessarily accepted, but I wasn't bothered. So I graduated high school and I chose not to go on to university. I spent a year working right out of high school. But I also worked while I was in high school at the local hotels, waitress, I got to know a lot of people. And my house parent, who was a professor at the university, used to take me to events at the university to expose me to what post-secondary education was about, to learn the system, which is the reason why my mother and father, in particular my father, sent my elder sister and I to private home placement. My dad, who was a Second World War veteran and who was a survivor of the residential school system, as was my mother, told my sister and I when we were going to be sent away to high school, private home placement, he said, you have to go out there and learn the way of the society out there, because you're going to have to live out there and you're going to have to learn to function out there. And you have to make sure that you never depend on a man to take care of you. And so that always stuck in my head. So I took the year off after high school to go and work. And I worked in a high school as what was called an educational assistant. And what it was it was still the integration movements, because I graduated high school in 1973, decades ago now. And so this high school I went to work in was in another town 20 miles from my home community. And I applied and I was interviewed and I got the job. And what it was they were needing educational assistants to work with kids who were being bused in from another reservation to go to school there. And they were of our language. They were Dakota relatives of mine. And so I went to work there for a year. And that's where I met my husband initially in 1973, when we were both quite young. We were still teenagers. So that experience, that 1 year of working with kids in the high school, but not being able to have a say other than to just help, I decided I wanted to get into education because of that. And so I did. I started my post-secondary education. I went to university in the States because we can. We can live, work, go to school in the United States without having to have citizenship, because the United States recognizes us as being citizens of the United States. As well, we are considered Canadians. We were born in Canada. But I consider myself a citizen of the land that we were given to caretake, which is North America. And so I don't recognize that boundary, that border, that artificial boundary between Canada and the U.S. But getting back to that, so I went and became a teacher. There was a policy in place. I couldn't teach in my home community until I got 2 years of experience elsewhere. So I did. Then I came home to work with my community. I only taught a year, and then our then director of education was leaving. And he took me under his wing and he started teaching me what it meant and what the role entailed. Because at a very early age, I was asked to speak on behalf of our community, by the community, because of my high school education out in the city. And because I became quite proficient at public speaking at a young age, because my mother and my father put me out there to do that quite often. And I overcame the fear of public speaking probably in 10th grade, because I had to do it in our English classes. And I decided I was going to become really good at English because I was going to go into university. And it was a course that I graduated with the highest marks in high school, even though it was my second language, because I knew I needed it to be able to succeed, to be able to be seen as having the voice to be able to speak in English. And so I learned along the way, and a lot of it had to do with what I was taught as a child about watch, listen, observe, and learn what you need to acquire the knowledge you need for yourself to walk a good life. And so that has carried me through my lifetime. So yes, I went on to university, and yes, I have, you know, dual master degrees, but what is my foundation is how I learned as a child, how I was taught from my grandmother and my parents in that natural watching, observing, doing, and learning from that, and what I needed to be good at whatever it was I was going to do. That foundation is what carries me today. It's not what I learned from university. All that did was help me get a job. What has carried me is what I learned when I was a child.
The values and the stories and the perspectives are still where you come from.
Yep. Love, compassion, respect, truth, honesty, helping, giving, all of that. That is what we still do. Because if we don't, then we're not being Dakota. And I'm a Dakota woman. It's my responsibility to do all that.
I mean, that's a beautiful story. I'm really glad you told it. But the idea of what is education, and it was interesting in my research when I spoke to these young people, because those values that you just named, that again, in my research, were care, connection, community, and choice, when they feel that, they can learn anything. So it's like the particulars of whatever, but it has to be in relationship. And to feel that they matter, they have a place, they know their community, they know why they're here. Those things are essential, and it's been missed in our, I called it Western education. There's probably many ways to talk about it. But what I feel and continue to feel is that are young people learning more of the Indigenous ways, more of the ways you were educated, only benefit our young people. And there's a desire to go back to that. What I would say is that in the 10 years since we met, you know, I had a near-death experience. And after that, I developed this passion for connection with the land, with Mother Earth, that was always there, but it became more prominent. And so I have immersed myself in understanding how it operates, how it works, what its natural laws and systems and resources. And hearing you speak, I realize that a lot of the values that I've been bringing more and more into the ranch that I live on are very similar to what you speak of, because you talk about seven generations. Well, I started gathering our group here in meetings and saying short-term decision-making isn't going to work here. My new value is it has to be 100 years. And it's a completely different way of making decisions. And it looks not clever if you're a capitalist. You know, wait, what about the bottom line? Well, my value changed and the bottom line is no longer. It's about that 100 years value and the health of the land, because how can I produce food here? How can we produce food here on soil that isn't fully healthy? And how can I be fully healthy if I'm not eating that food or living on land? Yeah, so there's a reciprocity.
It's like our last con when we talk about kinship. We are of the land and part of the land. We are kin to the land, just like you are kin to your children, just like you're kin to your parents and your grandparents. And that part is lost, is that kinship. A lot of people don't know how they're related or how we are intended to support each other to thrive. That has been really lost, and our nuclear families have become fractured because of it. And we've lost that sense of how we support each other. And the reason why I focus a lot on that is because of the fracturing of our families during residential school and the forced location and relocation onto reservations. Our families were decimated because of that. Also, is we have to know who our relatives are, our brothers, our sisters, our aunts, our uncles, our cousins, because it's our lifeline. And as a family, first of all, we have to know who we are. I'm Dakota. I know who I am. I know my responsibility. I have responsibility to honor all of the contributions of my parents and my grandparents and what they've done. I have a responsibility to uphold their name and to always carry it with honor and dignity, all of that. And we don't do the same with our relationship with the land, because there's an assumption it's always going to be there. There's an assumption it's there just for us to take from, but not to give back to it. And if we don't give back to it, it's not going to be able to provide for us. And we're at that stage now. And what you're saying is true. If you don't have a relationship with it, how is it your food is going to grow? How are you going to be able to sustain yourself or anything else that you have growing on the land? And that vital link is never, ever talked about, or is it ever considered in everything in the capitalist world that we live in?
The humility of that position is something that is not seen as a strength. You were speaking and saying that we consider ourselves guests. And guests, what are they like? Well, they come, they offer a gift. And I've recently learned about using cornmeal and tobacco and different things on the land. So when I go out for my walks or whatever I do, I now bring a little pouch. I have some things I carry with me and I make a little offering, and it's enhanced my relationship.
It's like when we go out and collect tipsina, our wild turnips, which we always used to use in our stews and soups. It's like, yes, you put tobacco down, you dig it up, but then you carefully put the top back so that it'll produce for you again for next year. Now, there's a lot of people that don't even know that. And so then our tipsina supply was really difficult to find it because people weren't collecting it properly. And we have to give back in order to receive. It's a simple law of nature. And that's something we've lost, because we are such an egotistical world, egotistical society. It's me, me, me first before anything and anybody else. And that just won't work. We are out to harm ourselves when we do that.
That's the thing, though, is that, you know, where you might think it feels better to be selfish, it actually doesn't. And that's the little secret. That's the paradoxical secret, is that giving is receiving. That's something that has been forgotten sometimes. And so I like to encourage that. My idea of philanthropy or giving or anything like that, it's like the secret is I'm receiving. It's really very selfish because it's gratifying and healing to me.
In our culture, giving is seen as being very honorable and very, I don't even have the term for it in English, why we do that. We have giveaways, and it's for honoring, and it's for thanking, and we have feasting. It's for honoring, and it's for thanking, and it's for acknowledging those who have helped us, or it's for acknowledging their support, or acknowledging the good things they've done. And we save year round every year to do that. I save all the time. It was a lesson my husband had to learn very quickly when he'd ask, well, what are we getting this for? And I'd say, to give away. And he'd just about choke. I said, because that's what we do. You know, we give, and without expectation of return, because it will come back to you naturally. And so we give every year, all year round, because that's what we're supposed to do, because that bounty that we receive was intended for us to share. It wasn't intended for us to keep to ourselves.
Well, I love hearing that, which you have to say. It always feels like a relief to me in some deep way. Another way of speaking, when I let you know that my mother had passed, you were referring to completing her walk.
Sure. I'll use my brother as an example because, first of all, he grew up farming with my father since a very young age. He was taken out of school at age 14 to help my father. And back then you could do that. And any farmer could do that, take their boys out of school at age 14 to help with the family farm. And my father farmed. And I'm using it as an example because he was younger than me, 1 year younger. So he helped my dad farm. Therefore, he helped provide for our family, our sustenance. He helped provide for our aunties, our grandmother, our kumshi, and for anyone else who needed food, he helped provide. So he did that his entire life. He farmed until he couldn't anymore when he became ill, when he had his first heart attack. And then that transformed into utilizing the skills he had learned as a young man from my dad and from just working with machinery to helping the community at their water plant and making sure the water plant ran so everybody would have their water, and clearing roads because he could and he knew how to operate heavy equipment because he learned that on a farm, into helping anyone who needed help. And he was always collecting. He was like my dad. They'd go to farm auctions and purchase stuff they didn't need. And he had all kinds of, I don't want to say derelict cars, but he had all kinds of vehicles in his yard. And I asked him, I said, Misu, younger brother, why do you have all these vehicles? And why don't we get rid of them and clean up? And he goes, no. He said, somebody's going to need a part someday. Somebody's going to need a part for their vehicle. Somebody's going to need a set of tires. Somebody's going to need this, need that. He always thought of others, not of himself. He didn't get those things for himself. It was because somebody was going to need them. And so when my father passed at a young age, my mother said to the whole family that he was now our patriarch. Even though he was younger than me, younger than my older sister, he was our patriarch. So then he took that role seriously. He never had any natural children of his own, but he married a woman who came with a daughter, and she was a baby when she came. And so that was his daughter. He adopted her. And people used to ask him, when are you going to have children of your own? And he would say, I have all these children I have to care for. I have enough, meaning his nieces and nephews, our children, as his brothers and sisters, because he had been given the responsibility of a patriarch. He took it seriously. And to help us raise our children, everybody listened to him. He was the law. And so even though he had said that he wanted to live, because his adopted daughter had a little girl almost three years ago now, he had said he wanted to live till she was 16. When he had a major cardiac event while he was out hunting with my youngest grandson, when we knew he couldn't recover from it. And I would talk to him in our language, even though he was unconscious, and explain things to him and let him know we were there and to encourage him and to pray with him. In the end, I told him that he had done everything he had been asked to do, to provide for the family, to provide for the community, to teach our children, to teach our grandsons, that he had completed his purpose, what he had been placed here to do, and to go on and meet our parents and our grandparents, knowing that he had fulfilled everything they had given him to do. And so that's how we were raised, in that sense of, we will go when we've completed our purpose. When we've done everything that the Creator has given us to do, then we have completed our purpose. Then we earn that walk to walk on to the next level. And so I use that as an example when I said, well, your mother completed her walk in life. And she walked on. We believe in that wholeheartedly. because we all have a purpose. We all have something we're supposed to do. And it's entirely on us to fulfill that. Because if we don't fulfill it, then we leave it to our grandchildren to carry for us. We leave them a burden, really, to fulfill their own purpose, but also then they have to complete ours. And so we don't do that. We fulfill our purpose in my family. We do the things we're supposed to do now, and we don't leave it for someone else to do for us.
Gosh, when you speak this way, it just really lands so deeply in my heart. Thank you so much, because it makes sense to me. I come from it as a psychologist, and the psyche, the heart mind, you might say, it's that same thing. It's like, if it's mine to do, I believe that. Carl Jung actually literally said it. The children live the unlived lives of their parents. So it's interesting. I don't know where he may have picked that up in the Pueblo maybe community, but that feels accurate. So we're here to do. And I feel that call myself right now. I wasn't so clear about this purpose, and now it's kind of come into focus. So I'm really having to accept that. And my goal is to understand it so I can fulfill it. And really highlighting the voices of people like yourself who have so much to teach us. So I just want to really thank you again for being here. So you mentioned that Dakota is a matriarchal culture, and I'm wondering how that works or how to understand it.
Women are what we call the foundation. They keep the home fires. They're the ones who bring forth the child, you know, through birthing. They're the ones who carry the child on their backs for the children to learn by observation and hearing and through a sensory way of learning until they are able to put their feet on the ground to walk. And then they start learning from the vibration of Mother Nature and so on. And again, our earth we call Mother Nature. So she's female, or she's matriarchal. She provides for all of us. Similarly, in our culture, we as women are responsible for our children till the females forever. Our aunties and our kumshi, our grandmothers, always are teaching our girls. The boys learn from their mother the language, although there is a male-female context in our language. They learn the meaning of, they learn about respect and love and caring and compassion, honesty, all of that, till about age 6. And then they're turned over to the males, the fathers, the uncles, the grandpas, to be taught their role as males in the family. So it's the female that starts the process. They are the important ones, the grandmothers, especially for teaching their grandchildren about the most important foundational knowledge that we have to have in order for us to build on it to grow up as adults.
I love that. And that's true in the culture I grew up in, only it's not acknowledged, is what I would say. It is still true. And the idea that women connect the babies and the children to nature and they orient the child.
And babies naturally are connected to what we call the heartbeat of nature, just because they were connected directly to the mother as a heartbeat. And the reason why we used to carry them on our backs is because then they are soothed and also connected to the mother's heartbeat. That's a connection. And it's the same thing with nature, the connection once you plant your feet on the ground. That's why people need to pay attention to nature, but also to how they're feeling when you're walking. And the reason why we always wear moccasins is because you can feel it. You can feel the land. How can you feel the land and know what's going on if you're always walking on concrete in hard-soled shoes? The connection is missing. You have to feel it. So those are the things I learned as a child, and those of my era learned. There's a lot of young people that don't learn that anymore.
Well, and also then, culturally, as adults, women make some of the decisions, would you say? Is that how that goes?
Yes, we do. Traditionally, and you know, when men would have council, they would always go back and get their home fire, their wives, their aunties and their grandmothers would always provide the input for the outcome of that decision-making process. Because women always make decisions based on how it was going to impact children and grandchildren and how it would impact home.
I love that. Well, thanks for explaining that. Before we go, I really want to ask, what would you really like us to take away? What are a few key thoughts that you really want us to hear and know about what you're here to teach us?
I'll share the same thing I often speak about with my husband, because he came from a Catholic background. He came from a society where he was never exposed to our people until he met me. He's white, for the lack of a better term. I call him a leprechaun because he's of Irish background. And so I asked him, it's like a check-in almost, because he's chosen to immerse himself in our culture, in my culture. How is life now since you've been with me, since you've joined our family? And not in a negative context, but what have you learned? Because I said, I cannot imagine living a life without purpose. I can't. I wouldn't know what to do. I'd be lost. And he has said that he has learned by walking and observing, because he has to, because he's got to help. In our culture, we're always helping, right? He's brought here for a purpose. And he's really cognizant of that, of why he came, why we were blessed with the opportunity to be together, and the purpose of that and what it means. And he's learning that every day. And I mean, it's been 15 years now, but he's learning that, and he's learned that. And really, I would ask people to step outside of themselves and step outside of their ego and fulfill their purpose. Find out what it is. You're not here just for yourself. Because if you were, you might as well go live out someplace all, you know, in the boondocks where you don't have any interaction with anybody or anything and just sit there. We all have a purpose. And when someone is not fulfilling their purpose, that means somebody else has to carry it for them. You and I have to carry it for them. And they become a burden instead of being that beautiful, whatever it was they were placed here for. Step outside of the ego and do what it is you're supposed to do, why you were placed here, and find out what that is.
And don't be limited by a narrow cultural definition of who you're supposed to be. I think that's one of the obstacles I see with young people and many of us that grow up. It's like, oh, I have to fit into this culture, but this culture doesn't have room, actually, maybe I believe, for who I actually am. So the idea would be to listen to what actually is inside you and what's coming through you, because that's a better hint than what the outside world might be telling you. Would you say that's so?
Oh, yeah, definitely, because we are, for the most part, constrained by what others think of us and say of us and how they view us, instead of following innately what we know to be what we are and what we are to develop into. We conform. It's like young girls these days, like the mean girl syndrome. Well, I'm better than you. Well, my clothes are nicer than yours. Well, I'm supposed to wear this. So then parents spend fortunes on kids and what they want from what they see in social media. Social media dictates everything right now with young people, and it's dangerous. It's dangerous, and parents aren't paying enough attention to it. And I am very cognizant of it because I have beautiful grandchildren, and I don't want them to grow up like that. So we don't need to conform to what social media is telling us we need to be doing. We need to be purposeful every day in why we're here. I have a beautiful granddaughter, beautiful granddaughters, and I always tell them, you were given what you have for a reason, and you need to pay attention to it. And you need to do that because that's what you're going to be remembered for. And I say that to young people, especially young people in the sense of 20-year-olds and so on that are in university. I said, what are you going to be remembered for? What did you do that you're going to be remembered for when you finish walking your life? It's not that it's something that you need to do, but because it happens naturally in fulfilling your purpose, people will remember that. How you helped. How one word turned somebody around. How you gave your last, you know, $10 out of your pocket to somebody who needed it. How you gave somebody a lift because they had to get somewhere and didn't have a way, and you just did it because you were going that way anyway. Those kind of small things can change a person's life. And we don't pay enough attention to that. The importance of our word, importance of our voice, it's the most powerful instrument that we have. It's the most powerful tool we have, our voice.
You're right. And the word, as you say, and that's where I just really want to wish you the best of everything with your effort bringing the language back to your schools. I know that's a really big project and there's a lot that could be said there. And maybe you'll come back and talk to us at some point in the future when that's up and going a little more fully. I'm very interested.
I would love to, because it's all going to turn out the way it's supposed to.
Exactly. But I'm very interested in immersing the people from that area in their native language. That's wonderful. Well, Catherine, thank you so much for making the time to be together today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for inviting me.
Well, I have so much to learn from you, and I appreciate the moments that you spend as that translator between the two worlds. You know, that's really who you are.
You know, our worldview, yours and mine, is similar. We just may go about it a different way of fulfilling how we see things. But if we all do that, good things come of it.
I agree. Okay, well, blessings to you and thanks again. We'll see you soon. Thank you for tuning in. If today's conversation inspired you, you can help us reach more people by sharing this episode with friends or leave a review. Be sure to subscribe so you never miss an episode. For additional resources, you can visit my website and stay connected with me on social media. A big thanks to the amazing team that makes this podcast possible, including Phil Svitek, Brianna Phipps, Leah Pellegrini, Melissa Walbridge, and Courtney Hamilton. When we all work together, we can create a world where positive change is not just possible, but inevitable.